Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we distill the crucial takeaways from the sources you need to be truly well-informed. Today, we're tackling a really critical mission. We're going to be providing some clarity on the UK legal landscape, specifically after that huge April 2025 Supreme Court ruling, the one that redefined sex in the Equality Act 2010.
And it is a huge one. This is one of those moments where a legal precedent just slams right into organizational reality. And it created genuine anxiety, you know, a lot of policy confusion across every single sector. So our job today is pretty simple. We want to give you a calm, authoritative framework. We need to help you make sure your practices stay lawful, proportionate, and maybe most importantly, dignified, even when the ground is, well, it's clearly shifted under our feet.
And the emotional stakes are so high. We've seen the reports. For the people directly affected, especially trans people who've lived legally in their acquired gender, sometimes for decades, the fallout has been described as a deep sense of betrayal, a feeling of being legally ghosted.
Exactly. When a legal definition changes like that, it really threatens the foundation of people's safety, their sense of belonging in your organization. And we just can't allow fear or exclusion to become the default response. It has to be clarity and care that lead the way. That's the only way to maintain trust.
Okay, let's unpack this legal reality then. Let's start at the source. What everyone really needs to understand is what the April 2025 ruling actually said. What's the core legal clarification we need for compliance?
Okay, so the core finding, it came out of the Four Women Scotland case. The Supreme Court clarified that the word sex in the Equality Act 2010 now defaults in certain legal provisions to biological sex. And the main place this applies is in the Schedule 3 exception. So anything related to single-sex services and spaces.
Right. And that sounds so definitive. I think that's where the panic starts for most organizations. They hear biological sex and they immediately jump to, we must exclude, full stop. But, and this is where it gets really nuanced and interesting, that ruling did not erase the rights of trans people. Can you explain that continued protection, the one under the separate characteristic of gender reassignment?
That separation is the absolute key takeaway. The protected characteristic of gender reassignment, which is in Section 7 of the Act, is it's completely unchanged. This characteristic protects anyone who is proposing to transition, who is currently undergoing it, or who has already transitioned. And crucially, that protection applies whether they've taken any medical or legal steps, like getting a gender recognition certificate or not.
So what we have are two protected characteristics, sort of running in parallel, but now they're defined differently in some specific situations. Sex is narrowed to biological sex for some purposes, and then gender reassignment still has this very broad protection against discrimination.
That's the critical divergence you have to grasp. It means trans people are still fully protected from general discrimination, hiring, promotion bias, that sort of thing. But their inclusion in single-sex spaces, the ones under Schedule 3, now requires a policy framework that goes beyond simple self-ID.
I have to pause on that GRC point because that causes so much confusion. I thought the whole point of the Gender Recognition Act 2004 was to legally change a person's sex for all purposes, including the Equality Act. Why did the ruling change the status for GRC holders?
And that's the subtlety that's creating the most risk. You're right, the GRC legally changes a person's sex for most legal purposes. But the Supreme Court clarified that for Equality Act 2010 purposes, and only for these specific applications, the definition of sex defaults to biological sex. So this means, legally speaking, a trans woman with a GRC is no longer automatically considered female under the protected characteristic of sex, but only for the purposes of those Schedule 3 exceptions in the Equality Act.
That introduces a profound ambiguity and a huge amount of risk for those individuals.
Absolutely. Think of people like Alexis, who we'll get to later, who transitioned legally maybe decades ago. Their status, which they thought was subtle, is now suddenly under review. But this brings us back to the core message that has to guide you. Inclusion is still lawful. The law defines the absolute minimum. Our policies, they define our culture.
Precisely. And if exclusion isn't mandatory, and as we said, it's often illegal, what is the legal mandate for deciding who accesses a single-sex space?
Yeah.
This is where every single organization needs to immediately understand and implement the proportionality test.
It is the mandate. There's no shortcut here. Any organization that even thinks about excluding a trans person from a single-sex service has to apply this strict three-part test. You can't just rely on general discomfort or a gut feeling.
Okay, so break down those three essential non-negotiable parts for us. What's the very first hurdle?
First, you have to establish a legitimate aim. There must be a specific evidence-based reason for the exclusion. And we're talking about things like a genuine safeguarding risk or maintaining privacy in a really intimate setting, like a domestic violence refuge or a clinical changing room. The sources are crystal clear on this. General public discomfort, speculation. That's not a legitimate aim in a legal defense.
That distinction is so important. The reason have to be objective, defensible, not based on feeling. So if you have a legitimate aim, what's the second thing you have to prove?
Proportionality. And this is where most organizations fall down. The exclusion has to be the least restrictive means possible to achieve that aim. You, as the provider, have to show that you considered and then explicitly ruled out less intrusive alternatives before you jump to exclusion.
So let's take a gym. They're concerned about privacy in the women's changing room. What are some of those less restrictive alternatives they have to consider before they can just put up a cis women only sign?
They'd need to prove they looked at things like enhanced privacy measures, so floor-to-ceiling cubicles, maybe private showering options, better staff training, or single-user facilities that are available to absolutely everyone who wants privacy. If they just implement a blanket ban on trans women, they have to be able to justify why every single one of those other options wasn't enough. And if they can't prove that effort, they are very likely engaged in unlawful discrimination.
Which means a blanket ban is almost guaranteed to fail this test. And the third element is purely practical, but if you miss it, the other two don't even matter.
Documentation, the decision, the rationale, the detailed consideration of every alternative, it all has to be documented, usually through an equality impact assessment, an EQIA. If it's not written down, dated, and signed off as proportionate, then legally you never did the test at all.
Mm-hmm.
The EQIA is your primary defense mechanism. It's not just a box-ticking exercise.
This all sounds like a lot of intricate, you know, legal theory. To really ground this in human reality, we need to stress test these policies against real people's lives. And this is where that persona impact model comes in. It moves us past just compliance checklists and really focuses on avoiding dignity harm.
Yes, because the law's shift has inadvertently created new, specific, and often invisible harms that policies now have to be designed to counteract. We need to see these policies through the eyes of the people most affected.
Okay, let's start with Alexis. She's a longstanding employee, a trans woman. She has a GRC. Her legal status should be rock solid. But it's not, is it?
Alexis is at high risk. She faces potential misclassification in these deeply embedded HR systems. Think about that the data feeds for pensions or payroll or benefits. They might inadvertently revert her classification to her birth sex based on this narrow definition. That's profoundly harmful. But even worse, if that HR error leads to her GRC status being publicly disclosed, that's a criminal offense under Section 22 of the Gender Recognition Act. Your systems must protect her data, not expose her.
That just puts such a fine point on the risk. It's not just a policy failure, it's potential criminal liability for the company. Okay, next, let's consider Rosa. She's an intersex woman, legally female, but has XY chromosomes.
Rosa's persona just challenges anyone who thinks biological sex is a simple binary. She lives her whole life as a woman, but her biological variation puts her at high risk from any policy that tries to define sex based only on chromosomes. She's afraid of being reclassified or excluded from women-only groups like a workplace leadership track just because of her medical history. Her privacy, her legitimacy, they're all threatened by these rigid policies that don't get the biological nuance.
So a policy that tries to be compliant by requiring proof of certain chromosomes would just automatically exclude Rosa and expose the organization to a legal challenge.
Exactly. It shows why these simple exclusion criteria are so often discriminatory, even if the intent was just to comply. And finally, we have Sky, a non-binary professional.
Since non-binary identities aren't legally recognized in the UK, where does Sky's specific dignity harm come from?
Sky faces what is basically structural exclusion, an erasure. Because UK legal and HR systems are so stubbornly binary, Sky is constantly forced to pick an identity on forms and in systems that just rised. It doesn't exist for them. This creates a high dignity harm risk, a feeling of being completely overlooked by policy. Any policy that only talks about men and women fails people like Sky. It leads to misgendering and exclusion.
The lesson here is so clear. Compliance isn't just about dodging a lawsuit. It's about making sure our policies don't inflict these specific documented harms on people like Alexis, Rosa, and Scott.
That's it. Inclusion doesn't live in the high-level statutes. It lives in your day-to-day HR records,
yeah,
and your facility signage, in how your managers handle conflict.
So let's pivot to the actionable steps. For our listener, the leader, the HR professional, What are the four key organizational commitments needed right now to maintain that psychological safety and start rebuilding trust?
Okay, first and foremost, you have to reiterate this commitment. Documentation is key. You must use the EQIA framework for every single policy review that touches on sex or gender. This isn't a one-off. It's a continuous process to ensure every decision is proportionate, recorded, and based on evidence, not fear.
Second, facilities. This is where the conflict is most visible. How do we apply the proportionality test here in a practical way?
Facilities and choice. You have to provide single-sex facilities as required. But, and this is the key, you must always offer single-occupancy, gender-neutral facilities as an optional choice. And here's the critical distinction. You can never compel a trans person to use that single-user facility. That's segregation. And it's highly likely to be seen as harassment. Choice has to be for everyone who wants privacy, not a tool to quietly exclude one group.
Makes perfect sense. Third, staff interaction. How do we stop our frontline teams becoming, you know, the unintended identity police?
This needs a huge overhaul of staff training. The focus has to shift from policing identity to managing behavior. Managers and frontline staff need to be explicitly trained not to ask someone to prove their sex or show paperwork. If staff challenge someone based on how they look or their own discomfort, they are risking a harassment claim on behalf of the whole organization. Your duty is to manage antisocial behavior from anyone, not to enforce exclusion based on appearance.
And finally, the privacy element. So crucial for people like Alexis and Rosa.
Privacy and data. GRC status, gender history, intersex status. This must all be treated as highly sensitive, protected data. It's special category data under GDPR. Access to it must be strictly limited. The organization has a massive legal and moral duty here. Mishandling this data isn't just bad HR. It can be a criminal offense.
So the cultural principle under all of this is that the organization's duty is to support inclusion and protect dignity, not to let individual staff enforce their own beliefs. The organization is ultimately liable.
Absolutely. While holding a belief is protected, manifesting that belief in a way that harasses or excludes someone else, that is not protected.
So as we wrap this deep dive up, the lesson seems clear. While the legal definition of sex has been narrowed in very specific contexts, the overarching duty to eliminate discrimination, advance equality, and act with strict proportionality means inclusion is still the only lawful and dignified path. You, the leader, define that experience.
We have to look at the outcomes. The test of a good policy isn't just if it's legally defensible, but does it prevent the dignity harms we've been talking about?
If a policy is technically compliant, but it causes profound harm like reclassifying Rosa or forcing Alexis to disclose her GRC, does it really serve the purpose of equality? The law is demanding clarity and care now more than ever. So our challenge to you this week, what is the one quick win you could take to embed that proportionality test right now? Maybe it's just auditing your facility signage or adding a privacy screen to a changing area.
And remember this sentiment. Even when the ground shifts under our feet, inclusion is not optional. It's who we are. It's a prerequisite for a trustworthy and successful organization.